Chapter 9. Aspen. Aspen grimaced as Kor's whining continued. The goat hadn't stopped complaining since the moment his luxurious coat of fur had fallen in drifts around his hooves. Well, that wasn't entirely true, because he'd spent most of the first 15 minutes or so regurgitating, and he'd barely been able to get a word out between heaving gasps, even mentally. As soon as the last of the dry heaves faded, though, the ruminant had stumbled away, hiding his smooth pink skin behind a stand of berry bushes on the opposite side of the tree's clearing. Even Aspen had been hard put to keep a straight face as the goat's bare behind swayed drunkenly, and Rouge had nearly been in tears, in spite of her own obvious misery. The girl's lips and tongue had been swollen to twice their usual size, and her appearance had not made maintaining his own calm facade any easier. Rouge had vanished almost as quickly as Kor had, though her laughter had been much easier to handle than the goat's incessant lamentation. As amusing and well-deserved as the situation was, Aspen genuinely hoped that Kor's fur would regrow as quickly as it had fallen once the debuff wore off. Unfortunately, Kor's sense of time was about equal to his ability to read, which meant both were essentially non-existent. The goat had been too distracted by his own sudden nudity to pay much attention to the image that should have told him how long he would have to suffer, and so the best they could hope for was that it was on a par with the 5-hour time limit placed on Rouge. Now night had fallen over the farm, resting gently on golden ears of corn and brilliant green leaves. Jewel-like strawberries nestled beneath foliage, and even the bees had fallen silent, so the only sound was Kor grumbling about how cold and exposed he felt. Aspen pulled his down pillow more firmly around his ears, in spite of the fact that he knew it wouldn't help. He sincerely envied those who were not mentally tied to the petulant goat. Fortunately, Kor was now mostly restricting himself to the link between Aspen and his soul-bound companions, so Silas was the only other one who had to listen to him, unless Sumi was able to hear the obnoxious sound somewhere in her molting dreams. Silas, of course, had taken advantage of her ability to fly and simply flown off, declaring that she wouldn't return until Kor grew fur or passed out. Aspen suspected that she'd gone back down into the cave system William had created, so he wasn't too worried, since Plum and Tomas would provide a safe haven for the little bat. After another few minutes of Kor's unceasing grousing, Aspen threw his pillow across the room and climbed out of bed. Clearly, he would get no sleep tonight, and though he could certainly force Kor to be silent, Aspen had something he needed to talk to Sarave about anyway. Putting it off wouldn't help, and he could tell by the faint sound of voices coming from below the floorboards of the house that the goblins were still awake. Cautiously, Aspen made his way to the hatch in the floor that led down to the former root cellar that had become Sarave, Juniper, and Nekthat's home. William had opened up more space for them, and Sarave had assured Aspen that it was now almost luxurious, but Aspen hadn't been down there since before he had left the farm. Leaning down, he carefully tapped at the hatch with the luminescent knuckles of his right hand, wryly reminding himself that he needed to get a leather glove made as soon as possible. It wouldn't do to have a constant nightlight giving away his location if, no, when Akuji and his minions came calling. The hatch raised slightly, and one yellow eye gleamed up at him, reflecting the light cast by his own hand. Upon seeing Aspen, Nekthat silently raised the door the rest of the way, before vanishing back down below. Aspen peered down, noting that there was a faint light gleaming up. Shortly after Juniper had been born, they had discovered that while she was able to see well in low light, she didn't have the dark vision granted to her mother's race. Nekthat and Sarave would have been entirely comfortable in pitch darkness, so the light was no doubt for the child's benefit. Aspen set his feet on the narrow top step of a set of stairs that had only been an idea when he headed south. The old ladder that used to be there was long gone, and while these steps were clearly made for a goblin-sized person, they were still a vast improvement. It took 15 of the short steps to reach the floor, and Aspen found that he still had to crouch slightly to keep from bumping his head, though otherwise the space was vastly different from what he remembered. The packed dirt walls were gone, replaced by smooth stone, and three tunnels now branched away from the main area, which was easily twice as large as its original 10x10 size. Sarave had filled the space with colorful hand-woven mats and hangings that put his own efforts at constructing anything from grass or reeds to shame. Dense and spongy fungi rugs covered the floor, also colored with natural dyes the goblin had created from nuts and berries she'd found around the farm. Hanging bundles of herbs dangled from the ceiling, strategically placed so that none of the residents would be inconvenienced by their presence. Aspen cursed slightly as a dried frond stabbed him in the eye, and he batted the cluster of greenery away, his patience already worn down by exhaustion and Kor's constant complaints. A gentle hand caught his before he could further damage the bundle, and he looked down to see Sarave's concerned expression. Nekthat stood nearby, his own face deliberately noncommittal as he looked at his sister and the human invader, but Aspen could still sense the male goblin's disapproval. Aspen drew in a deep breath and looked around. "Where's Juniper?" Sarave tilted her head toward a low piece of furniture that resembled a nest more than a seat. "She has her own bed, but she falls asleep out here most nights. She wants to stay up with me and her uncle, but her human half needs to rest while the moon is high." Sure enough, the little girl lay curled up in the wicker chair under a soft blanket that Aspen recognized as one of the ones he'd brought with him when he first fled from Bright. Her sleeping face looked more human than goblin in the faint light. The distinct green tinge to her skin was banished by the pale torchlight, and her inhuman eyes were concealed behind the sweep of long lashes on her soft cheek. Smiling fondly, Aspen nearly reached out to stroke a stray piece of pale brown hair away from the child's sweet face, but stopped himself before he'd done more than twitch. The girl was not his daughter, and nothing but the tenuous privilege of affection and familiarity gave him the right to touch her. Sarave squeezed his hand gently before releasing it, and he felt the faintest scratch of calluses on her small hand as she moved it away. She had worked hard to provide for her family and make this place a home. He would always admire her for that, no matter what might come between them in the future. Aspen sat down on the bottom stair step, noting with resignation that the surface only supported perhaps half of his posterior, and not particularly well. He rubbed his face tiredly and then looked over at Nekthat. "Could we have a moment, please?" The goblin's already thin lips tightened, and he looked at his sister. "Sarave Hijin, I think." Sarave shook her head. "Nekthat, I understand. You are," her mouth twisted a little, "if thin. I think Aspen has shown clearly enough that he means me no harm, however." Nekthat looked rebellious but bowed his head. "Skijudin sike leslet hozinte, Sarave." He stumbled a bit over the goblin tongue, unlike Sarave herself, who seemed to drop into it without thinking, as if she had learned it before any other. Aspen was fairly certain most goblins spoke only the common tongue or the pidgin language of those races who had been conquered by Akuji and forced into his service. The fact that his goblins spoke their own nearly abandoned Argo was yet another reason Aspen had long suspected that they were much more than they seemed. Sarave's answer was uncharacteristically sharp, and Nekthat's shoulders tightened before he bowed slightly lower and vanished down a tunnel to their left without further argument. Sarave turned back to Aspen, and her narrow, plain face was flushed when she met his eyes. "He is overprotective. He likes you very much, but he says that the last time he left me alone for too long, I ended up being exiled and left to die slowly for my sins." Her gaze shifted away. "Not that he thinks such a thing will happen again, but—" She shrugged, and the unspoken knowledge that her exile had only happened because of her love for a human man hung between them. Aspen cleared his throat, feeling his cheeks heat. "I'm sorry. I'll keep this brief, but I have something I need to speak to you about, and the matter is urgent." He cast a rueful look upward, as a particularly vituperative torrent of words came from a certain beleaguered goat. Sarave caught the look and laughed. "Still upset, is he?" Aspen chuckled. "That's putting it mildly." Smiling fondly, the goblin shook her head. "He did well while you were gone. At first, if I came upon him without sufficient notice, I could see the desire to kill me coursing through him. He sometimes trembled with it. But he is too loyal to betray you, and you asked him to guard us, and so he did." She grinned, and her sharp teeth flashed before she covered them with her hand. "I bribed him with treats too, and that seemed to help." Without thinking, Aspen caught her hand and gently tugged it away from her face. Her lips snapped shut, and she dropped her face so her loose hair fell around her cheeks and jaw. Aspen tucked a strand behind one pointed ear, then pulled his hands back and clenched them together in his lap. "Don't," he said a little harshly. "Don't hide your face or your smile. You are," he closed his eyes trying to find the words and failing miserably, "you, and there is nothing in the world wrong with you. So please don't do that." Sarave's eyes shot to his, her gaze searching and wary. He didn't know if she found what she was looking for, but a different kind of color crept over her face, and she smiled, though this time she didn't attempt to cover the sharp row of teeth. She simply nodded and said softly, "What do you need to discuss, Aspen?" Aspen shifted, reaching into the small pouch still belted at his waist. His fingers closed around something warm and smooth, and he pulled it out. He held out his hand, and then opened it, revealing an opalescent pearl nearly the size of his palm. Sarave's hands flew to her mouth, this time in shock as she gasped, "A city seed." Aspen held the city seed closer to Sarave, but the little goblin woman put her hands behind her back like a little child who sees something shiny but knows they're not allowed to touch. Aspen quirked a smile. "Take it," he urged gently. She shook her head, her eyes huge in her suddenly pale face. "Aspen Vicnity, do you know what you offer?" Aspen sighed, filing this new word away to ask about later. He'd very much like to know what it meant. "Freedom," he asked. "Freedom for you, for Juniper, and for your people if you want. I thought about giving you the dungeon seed for a moment, but I knew you'd hate all the fighting and being trapped within the dungeon. I think you've had more than enough of being trapped." Sarave's yellow eyes were lambent. "How is this freedom? You only offer me another kind of cage." She laughed just a little. "A prettier one, maybe, but no less a jail than all the ones I've been in before. Slave, daughter, wife, mother. Now you offer me queen as if it's a piece of candy or a pretty bauble you think I cannot resist." Aspen glanced over at Juniper, still sleeping the deep sleep of a child who knows they are safe among those who would die for them. "Is mother such a terrible prison? Was wife? Mother is the only pitfall from which I've had no desire to escape. Wife." The word hung heavy, and she closed her eyes. "Jeremy was a good man and a good husband, but I ran from one confinement to the next. In his madness he loved me, and for that love he died. Before he died he tied me down with silken ropes of hope and expectation. They weren't onerous, but they were never absent." Aspen dropped his hand back into his lap, the pearl rolling in his palm, mesmerizing in its beauty. "I have to do something with this thing. It was given to me to pay for a debt that was not yet owed, and now I find that the debt and the deposit are out of balance, though I have yet to decide in whose favor." He eyed the city seed with distaste. "I am already the Duke of the North. I owe allegiance to the King of Quarternell, who is almost certainly dead, and is most certainly another victim of Akuji." Sarave's sharp intake of breath made Juniper stir and roll over in her sleep. "Lord Akuji? How is this?" "He is dead." So Aspen told Sarave about all they had learned while they were in Bright. He told her about the escalating violence seething just beneath the surface, and the cult that was using hate and fear to recruit people from all walks of life. He explained how even the travelers were being tricked into joining the rising tide of rebellion, and that an evil man named Phantom Hat had official control of both Bloodhaven and Bright, and was busily destroying all that was good in both. Finally, he explained that he and his daughter Lark had given their lives for nothing. He couldn't prevent the bitterness from staining his voice, and by the end of the recitation, Sarave's hand was covering his own, though she carefully avoided any contact with the city seed. "Aspen, it's not your fault. You couldn't know that Akuji had discovered a path to true immortality. And your daughter didn't die for nothing. She gave you a chance to save your entire race from extinction, and you took it. Death takes us all, whether it is quietly or with violence, but very few can say their deaths changed the course of history. You know that better than most." "Screw history," Aspen growled. "I just want—" He bowed his head and tears trailed down his cheek. Sarave leaned forward and wiped the tears away, though her gaze lingered on her own sleeping child. "You want your daughter back. You would trade every human remaining in this world for her, most especially yourself, and you both hate and blame yourself for this, because you know that's not what she wanted." His shoulders shook just once, and then he forcefully pulled himself together. "Yes," he said simply. "But I can't have that, can I? Instead, I'm offered more power and riches than any man could dream of, and I wish for none of them. Most especially," he opened his hand to reveal the gleaming pearl within, "I do not want this." The goblin woman patted his knee once and leaned back. "Then what makes you think I want it any more than you?" Aspen's pale eyes turned toward Juniper. "You still have your daughter, Sarave. If you want her to live, you need to take it." Anger and shock warred for pride of place in Sarave's expression. "Are you threatening?" Aspen looked back at her, horrified. "No. Never. But war is coming again. With the return of Akuji, the cultists of the evil god, and this Phantom Hat leading the travelers, We're going to be at the epicenter of the storm, and even if you take Juniper and flee, no matter who wins, Juniper at least will spend her life in fear. These people hate those like her, the Half-Bloods, more than anyone else. He took a deep breath, then let it out slowly. If Akuji wins, he'll kill or subjugate everyone, human or other. Phantom Hat seems to want to kill anyone who isn't human, which includes you and Juniper. If I use this seed myself, as a human lord with no heir and strong ties to Quarternell, within a generation or two, this place will be the same as all the others, and Juniper or her children will be persecuted for their goblin blood. There is no one else I trust to use it well. What about Rouge or Mott? Sarave sounded merely curious, but her expression was conflicted. He shook his head. They're not here all the time, and their zombies are vulnerable. Their lives are elsewhere, and while they care about this place, we need a ruler who is constant and devoted. There must be someone else. Sarave. Aspen's voice was stern, but then it gentled. You know the requirements for use, do you not? The person who gave this to me. The head librarian? He started, then chuckled a little, realizing he and the old man had probably given themselves away 100 times to anyone who was paying attention, as Sarave always was. Yes. The head librarian told me that the user must be of a high level, must be wealthy, must be highly ranked or a saint, and must have an excellent relationship with their deity. Aspen raised a brow at Sarave as she sat back, relief clear on her face. I fail then. I can no more use that seed than I can fly. Aspen mirrored her movement, leaning back to rest an elbow on the stair behind him. He looked up at the ceiling as he spoke, rolling the glistening pearl between his fingers. He also said that if I use this myself, any city I create will belong in the end to the king I serve. I become the city overlord, yes, but my liege has the power to remove me. If I renounce my king, I lose the rank that allows me to use the seed. If I create the city and then attempt to secede, the city will lose rank, my citizens lose morale, and my king still has the opportunity to deny the secession, which he would, of course, do. In order to rebel, well, the consequences of that are even more dire, and I'm still likely to fail. Sighing, Aspen rubbed his eyes with his free hand tiredly, then continued. The head librarian and I had a fair bit of time together, and for some of it, I was recovering from mana burn and was unable to do much more than sleep and eat. The librarian likes to tell stories, and he told me one that I found very interesting. He looked back at Sarave, who refused to meet his eyes. He told me a little about the history of the goblins, you see. Or rather, the goblin Tay. He said that once they were a contentious but honorable people, like many others, except that they preferred to live in caves and travel through tunnels, rather than building cities above ground as most did. They were always led by a queen, and that role was passed down through the female line. The queen was well-educated, wise, and protected by her brothers, who were the military leaders. The queen was also the high priestess of their twin goddesses, Ji-Na and Atae. Then one day the goblin Tay, who were insular and disliked outsiders, were approached by a ghoul. This ghoul was the servant of a lich lord, who demanded they surrender to him. If they did, they would be absorbed into his empire, but the queen would be allowed to live as a figurehead. It was a lie, of course, for Akuji never left behind anyone who might incite rebellion, but they couldn't know that. In any case, the queen's brothers killed the messenger and sent his head back to Akuji, who had been busy fighting against the orcs, though that is another story. Akuji was furious at this show of disrespect, or so the story goes, and sent some part of his legions to crush the goblins. The goblins, though, refused to be destroyed so easily, and they fought a century-long war, though every member of their race who fell was only one more warrior who rose to fight their former brothers. At last, though, the goblins were defeated utterly. Their queen was presumed dead, her brothers massacred, and their formerly proud people reduced to an uneducated rabble who quickly became the lowest of the low in an empire which only cared about physical prowess. Rumors persisted, however, of a queen in exile who continued to be raised in the old way, waiting for the day when her people could rise again. Aspen dropped his gaze back to Sarave, who now refused to meet his eyes. This queen would be qualified to use the city seed in all ways but one. She would be strong, having been trained since birth to protect herself. She is a queen. The leader of a government in hiding, perhaps, but still a valid nation. As queen, she would also be a high priestess of her goddess, a role which requires a direct and positive relationship with that goddess. The only thing she lacks would be wealth. Aspen slowly leaned forward again, and this time he pulled stick from his belt. With a thought, he flipped open the metal end of the short cudgel, ignoring the reluctant chiming of the staff. Tipping the weapon, he poured a stream of sparkling stones into his hand. He set stick on the step beside him, then held out his hand, now filled with a city seed mostly buried in perfect glittering gemstones. Queen Sarave, I offer you this gift to begin your new kingdom. Your people need you, and your child. Will you accept? A single tear ran down Sarave's cheek as she finally returned her eyes to his. How did you know? Aspen laughed a little. Sarave, he said gently, do you know how many goblins I've met? Briefly, perhaps, and not in the best of circumstances, but I know how the average goblin thinks and acts. There is nothing average about you or your brother. When the head librarian told me this story, it was as if he'd handed me the missing piece of a puzzle. I knew from the moment you first spoke to me that you were different. Why do you think I brought you home with me? Why do you think Sumi and Kor accepted you as easily as they did? He ran the hand that wasn't filled with a king's or queen's ransom through his hair. Quite aside from the fact that you were pregnant, terrified, alone, and a follower of our goddess, you were clearly educated, thoughtful, and when you weren't driven almost mad by concern for your child, you were wise. You are no more one of the degenerate products of Akuji's rule than I am. I hoped you would trust me enough to tell me your story, all of your story one day, but time has run out. Looking again toward the caves currently housing a small horde of refugees, he continued. If these people begin building a hamlet, as they plan, they will feel that they have ownership of it. Ownership and citizenship are very different things. Not only will they fail, because what they can build in time could never be enough to face what is coming, but the only leader they will have is me. Aspen sighed and met Sarave's eyes, smiling ruefully. For all that I am well educated now, I was raised in a small town among simple folks. I rose to where I am through luck, good and bad alike, and am no more qualified to be a king than is Kor. He chuckled. Kor might be better actually because at least he has the confidence to command others, while I wish nothing more than to be left to grow wheat and someday be able to eat bread again. He rubbed his belly. I missed bread last winter. Real bread, fluffy and light with a sweet crisp crust drenched in butter or jam. When we reached Bright and I found my hidden chambers intact, I gave Rouge money and magic pouches and had her fill one with nothing but bread. Sarave laughed a little and rubbed at her moist eyes. I tried, Aspen, but without a mill to grind the wheat fine enough, there was little I could do. I thought you liked my cornbread. Aspen quirked a smile and bowed just a little. Your cornbread was the highlight of my winter meals, Your Majesty. Sarave huffed a little breath that was half laugh and half sob. Then she stuck out her small moss-green hand. All right, Duke Aspen, Hosinte Sakinte, Lord of the North, I accept your proposal. I will build you a city, and I will drag my people kicking and screaming back from barbarism. Aspen carefully poured jewels and city seed into the faintly trembling palm. Gems trickled over the goblin's much smaller hand and flowed to the floor, and when the city seed at last touched her skin, the world changed for the second time that day.